Hey there, this is Adam White. I'm recording in my basement in Niagara Falls, Ontario. If you are a regular listener of the Punk News Podcast, this isn't exactly that. The next regularly scheduled episode will be in your feed soon. This is the audio of an interview that I recently conducted with KJ Jansen, the frontman of Calgary pop punk band Chicks Dig It, and I thought you guys might want to hear it. If you are not a regular listener of the Punk News Podcast and you got in here because of the Chicks Dig It thing, welcome. If you want to find out more about us, you can go over to punknews.org and click on podcast in the menu, or head over to iTunes and search for the Punk News Podcast, and you can find our episode archive there. We are a show in which two or three people from the punknews.org family get together to have an incredibly irreverent discussion of the news and new songs and various happenings, and we try to do one of those every week, so please check it out if you've never heard it before. So this is going to be an interview with KJ from Chicks Dig It. The band is celebrating 25 years together. Fat Records is gearing up to release their new full-length, which is called 2012, 2012, but we're gonna say 2012 because this is a Rush riff, and that's what we're going to do here. So you can find more info on that over at fatrec.com. It comes out on September 16th, which is a Friday, and I suppose it would be a Friday because they're all Fridays these days. And the band is playing shows in and around Canada to support this thing. On September 22nd, they're going to be in Ottawa playing the very cool pierogi and pinball venue House of Targ. On September 21st, they'll be in Montreal at Petite Campus. On the 23rd and 24th, the band will be in Toronto, Ontario, playing the Bovine Sex Club. Those are going to be big, exciting release shows. You should really try to get out to one of those if you are in the area. On September 25th, the band will be in London playing Call the Office, and there are going to be more tour dates coming up across the country and probably around the world. So you should go check out fatrec.com or punknews.org in I'm sure the coming days, where you'll learn more about that stuff. So let's play a little bit of a Chicks Dig It song, and then we're going to jump in and talk to KJ about the 25 years as a band, about the new record, about hockey, about Canadian shit, lots of stuff. Here we go. Hello.
Hey, Adam. How's it going?
Not too bad.
I'm good.
So you got some time? We can do this now?
Yeah, absolutely.
Cool. Well, thanks for chatting with me today. I've actually got sort of a sordid history of botched Chicks Dig It interviews that I'm trying to live down. So it means a lot that I can hopefully do this and do it right.
Okay. I've probably botched more Chicks Dig It interviews than you have, I think.
Well, I'm sure you have. We sat down. I want to say it was probably around when Pink Razors came out, either before or after. You, me, and Aubin, who's the publisher of Punk News, and we sat down in person at there was a restaurant in Toronto called the Shanghai Cowgirl.
Right.
And you were playing a solo set at the Bovine right after that. And we sat down and we did an interview that in my mind was the greatest interview ever. And then we got back and we had one of those little crappy little tape players that uses the tape from an answering machine.
Right.
And afterwards we got home to transcribe it. And when we turned it on, it just was hissing.
Oh no.
Hissing and like coffee cup clanking noises for about an hour. So I felt bad. So,
well, I don't know why you would feel bad. I mean, it's just sometimes those things happen, you know, and it was probably, I probably bumped the machine or something. It was probably my fault at the end of the day.
You know what? If we didn't have a history of screwing those things up, then I would let you take the blame for that. But okay. I don't know if I can do that. So I guess what our readers probably really want to know more than anything at this point, is how you're coping with the loss of Taylor Hall to the Devils.
That's a good question. I was surprised by that trade. And as you know, I'm an Oilers fan. But, you know, we did get a defenseman, which is hard to get. I would have liked to have seen a little bit more come back. But that's the way it goes. And, you know, I've heard a couple players have spoken out since. Ben Scrivens and the former goalie, and Oscar Klefbom, the current one of their current top defensemen, and they both said the same thing about Taylor Hall not really being, you know, the best guy for the job. So anyway, yeah, I mean, it's a bummer, but I can also understand it.
Well, see, I had to go back and check your Twitter history, because there was that one, there was the day when the trade happened where there was this massive collective outpouring of Oilers grief online, and you were conspicuously silent, and I was like, oh no, like he was distraught.
Well, you know, it's sort of one of those things where I love the Oilers, and I have, you know, since I was, you know, a little kid, and but you know what, I gotta say, sometimes their fans really, you know, it's sort of that Sloan lyric that says it's not the band I hate, it's their fans. Sometimes I kind of feel that way about Oilers fans. They're a little bit, you know, dramatic.
Now, you live in Calgary these days, right?
Yeah.
So are you in enemy territory at that point? Like, do you have to hide this, or is there plenty of Oilers people that are, you know, out in the open and proud of it?
Well, probably the only, you know, punk thing I've done in my life is be an Oilers fan growing, because I grew up in Calgary, but I was born in Edmonton. So, yeah, I just grew up an Oilers fan in Calgary during the 80s when, you know, the Battle of Alberta was like a thing. And yeah, so there was some tough days, I have to say.
So we're, of course, chatting because it's the 25th anniversary of the band. And I'm sure you've been asked a million times in recent interviews and things like that about the really early days. So I'm going to try to avoid hitting you with, you know, what was it like on Sub Pop questions? Because okay. I think you've been through a bunch of those. So I'm really more interested in what you're doing right now. And in particular, you know, how's life as a dad compared to, you know, life on the road?
Yeah, well, I guess I've been a dad for almost 7 years. We have two kids, and we have a one-year-old boy right now, and so he's just starting to really move around, so it's a lot of time and effort goes into just making sure he doesn't hurt himself, because he's kind of fearless.
Well, see, I saw the picture that you posted at Father's Day on Instagram, and it mirrors what I'm going through right now, because I've got, well, not as old as you, but I have a three-year-old girl and a one-year-old boy. So okay, yeah. I looked at that picture and I thought, oh God, he's going through what I'm going through. So
yeah, you know, it's great. Like, I think that's why, you know, little kids are cute, because I'm sure there would be no human race if they had made little babies funny looking, because they're, you know, you go crazy in the middle of the night. I'm sure some caveman would have left his kid in the forest and we wouldn't have made it to this point, you know, a long time ago. I jest, of course. I'm sure there's probably gonna be some people upset about that comment, but you know, yeah, it's you know, I love being a dad and kids, you know, having kids, it's a totally different game. It's like being on tour. It's actually exactly like being on tour, except you don't drive around all the time.
I find I still have to drive around all the time.
Well, you know, that's the point. You don't drive from city to city. You pretty much just drive around your own city all the time. You're right.
So when you guys are playing in Calgary, maybe your son's a little bit younger for this, but like, has your daughter come and saw you?
Actually, she just saw us play for the first time this summer, because we don't play much in Calgary. And most of the time when we play, it's a bar show at midnight or whatever. So we haven't... in the last few years, we've been kind of not as busy, especially here in our own hometown. So, yeah, at 6.5 was the first time that she saw us play. So, and she said she was very proud of me.
Did you have to put those globe-sized headphones on her to...
Yeah, there's actually... It's funny, we got to the festival that we were playing, and a couple people... We had just stepped out of the car, and there was a woman there who's like, you got to put headphones on these kids. And it's like, okay, just give us a second. We just got out of the car. But we had those headphones, and they stayed on for the show, because she knew that if the headphones came off, she had to go to bed because we're playing at midnight. We let her stay up late.
Every once in a while, you see someone that has a baby at the bar and they're wearing the headphones, and the size of the cones on them is basically the size of the baby's head. And
yeah.
I don't even know how they hold them up, but it's amazing whenever I see it.
Yeah, but I'm glad people are doing that. And I'm glad to see more people at shows wearing earplugs because, I mean, a lot of friends of mine who've been going to shows for a long time are going deaf. So I think it's good to see that just people are conscious of their hearing, or you're protecting their hearing.
Well, see, I actually wanted to touch a little bit about what you were seeing as changes, and in particular with Calgary. I mean, Calgary for me has always been a little bit of a magical place from a musical standpoint. And this is only because I think it's just circumstance. One of the first live bands that I had ever on my own went to a bar to go see was Huevos Rancheros.
Hilarious.
And then like a couple weeks or a couple months later was you guys. And I'm in Niagara Falls. So this was in St. Catharines there was a club called the Frat House that was right there. And both of you guys played there within a few months of each other. And this would have been, I don't know, like maybe like 97 or 98 or something like that. And what I knew was that, like, whenever I went to see a rock and roll band, they seemed to be from Calgary or Vancouver, because the Smugglers were in town just before that. And then whenever I went to see a ska band, they're from Montreal. And there was never anything good that was coming out of Toronto at the time. So Toronto was a wasteland. All the ska was from the east and all the rock and roll was from the west. So Calgary's always sort of been amazing to me from that standpoint. But I don't know if that at all matches up with anyone's experience of it. But you've been in Calgary for your whole life, basically. So you've seen the population boom. You've seen, you know, all the money coming in from all the oil and everything. Mm-hmm. So. Yeah. How different does it feel, despite the fact that you're 20 years older at this point, but how does Calgary feel from a music and art standpoint compared to what it was?
Well, I think, you know, back when we started going to see shows and bands, the real arts capital of Alberta was Edmonton, and it still in a lot of ways is, but Calgary has definitely caught up. Back then there was a lot more of I don't know. I think bands just wanted to stay in Calgary and play. There's only a few bands that actually wanted to leave and go out. In the mid '90s, that kind of changed a little bit. And so bands, you know, like Forbidden Dimension, Huevos were kind of the pioneers of touring. They were the first band that we knew of that were, you know, traveling and playing music, and they were the like our big brothers. So you know, wanted to do what they were doing. So that's why we started touring too. But I think now it seems like, I would say that I think the bands here in town are supported more locally than they were then. We always, like, I'm not saying we didn't get a lot of support, but I think in general, I think, it's stronger now. And I think just music or bands in general now, the people in them, the people that are younger than me are a little bit more fearless and a little bit more ready to try different stuff. And so, yeah, it seems like things have kind of gotten a little bit more open and less defined by genre and what you're supposed to do and that kind of thing.
Yeah.
I think, you know, I don't want to say kids these days, but yeah, I would say kids these days really are way more open to stuff and way more like adventurous or something. They just seem like they're ready to try anything, which is really cool.
So does having kids of your own change your perspective on what kind of music you want to write at this point? I mean, just think it's always been so irreverent and youthful and everything that you've put out. And now you're faced with all sorts of youth, but it's not necessarily your own.
Yeah, I think anything's really changed with what we write about or what I write about. I mean, I'm still the same person. I just, you know, I think I'm reminded more of, you know, childhood things by seeing how, you know, my daughter reacts to things, you know, and she's around the age now. Like, I was 7 or 8 when my sister started bringing home punk records. So I was exposed to it, you know, earlier, but I didn't really do anything about it until way later. But I think, you know, I'm watching her, you know, see a band for the first time or, you know, listen to a certain kind of music the first time. You know, she's never listened to the Ramones. She's 7. We've never played her the Ramones. It's just we haven't gotten to that yet, you know. And but I'm looking forward to that. So I don't think it's changed anything. It's just brought certain things back for sure.
Is there that temptation that you want to start giving them their education in what you consider to be like canonically good music? Because I've definitely had that, and I've had to back off sitting her down and saying, okay, we're going to walk through every Clash record right now and figure out which of these works for you. Definitely had little moments where, you know, I've been playing like a new Pornographers record, and she would come in when she was 2.5 or so and dance around the room. And that was amazing. Mm-hmm. But I'm trying to not be the uncool dad and just force, old man music on my kid.
Yeah. I think, you know what, you know, your kids are going to figure it out and discover it. And I mean, it's going to be around the house, and they're going to see you wearing the t-shirts and all that. Anyway, I know our daughter is going to figure it out. And she, like, I can tell already, she knows what a good song is. She knows, she can understand melody, and she's playing piano. She's learning piano right now, and she's got a really good ear. So I think, you know, she's going to figure out what she likes by herself. You know, it's like, I don't know. I'm just not concerned about that. I think I want them to figure it out themselves.
Cool. Mm-hmm. So, I spent the past few days frantically searching Google while listening to 2012 on repeat to kind of unpack what you were doing on there lyrically. So this record, for anyone that hasn't heard it, is one giant song with a bunch of smaller movements, little mini songs that kind of bridge everything in between. And it plays out like a travelogue of the band's tours back in 2012. Now, I've been chasing details to see how much of this is stuff I could actually verify compared to how much it was just lyrics. And there is, you've done your homework on your own tour here, because I would go in and I'd be like, okay, Nimrod, like that's not a venue in Dusseldorf, but oh, he's referring to the German band, the Nimrods. And then, you know, did they actually play with the Carbonites in Orangeweil? Yes, they did. Right. And I'm going through all of this stuff. So, I mean, kudos. It's a really cool concept to walk through, you know, a whole year of touring like that. But what I was really looking at, this was, I was looking at it, and it obviously has the big funny Rush cover art that you've put together. So what came first? Did you set out to make something called 2012 and then go find a tour, check what happened in 2012 and see if you can make it match? Or were you intending to just to chronicle that year, and then you happen to realize the symmetry with the Rush record?
Well, it's a lot of stuff went into the, even before we even did it, it was a lot of things that kind of happened. At the end of the year 2012, Mark O'Flaherty, who's the original guitar player, had sort of decided that he wasn't going to do it anymore. And so we had a conversation just about, you know, well, let's take a break. We don't have to like make any decisions, you know, and I didn't want him to quit, but I knew, you know, at the time that, you know, it was probably the best thing for him. And so I think we took 6 or 8 months off, and I just had started writing and I had a couple songs that happened to be, the choruses of them happened to be about places we had played the year before. And then I noticed a few more kind of came along, and I had 6 or 8. And so I thought, oh, you know what? Like, you know, if he quits, I'm going to write a song for him that, you know, sort of talks about our last year of touring together, and you know a love song for your buddy. And then we decided it would be funny, because you know it's widely regarded that The Decline by NoFX is the greatest punk rock song of all time, and in a lot of people's minds. So we thought, if we made our song 1 second longer than The Decline, then our song would be greater. So then we would then have the title of the greatest punk rock song of all time.
Mathematically, yes.
Yeah, right. Nobody can argue that. And then so, and then we started piecing all this together, and we were like, you know, a few times The Decline in terms of length. So we had to start cutting stuff out and making it, you know, sort of, yeah, you know, we had to cut a lot out. And then doing some research, we saw that The Decline was the second longest song. So we thought, hey, well, let's go for the longest one. But then we wanted to fit it onto a side of a record. It's a lot of little things anyway. So that's kind of how it came out. And and even when we recorded it in the studio, which we did it in one take, not all the, you know, overdubs with the vocals and everything, but we did the bass, the drums, and the one guitar track in one take. So that was a huge thing for us because we cannot even do a 2-minute song in one take normally. And then we were still too long, so we still had to cut some out after that. So it's been a lot of, you know, making things go into the next part and have it make sense musically, and then making the length right. It was, you know, a lot of things. And then, of course, fact checking like you did all the stuff in the song. And there's a few facts that I'm sure are wrong.
So is it your intention that this is something you guys are going to play as a 20-minute block, or are you going to chunk it up into bits?
Well, as we recorded the bed track, you know, about a year and a half ago. So, and we've slowly been, we had it done basically, about a year ago. But we've just been not able to tour or do anything about it. So, it's kind of sat for a while, but at the time we could play it no problem. One go.
Oh, wow.
So it's something that we could do. Although right now, we probably couldn't, but we've definitely done it many times before.
Well, I feel it took 10 or 15 years for NoFX to sort of like work up the balls to play The Decline live. Like that was just something that didn't happen, and then all of a sudden they started busting it out. So,
well, if it, you know, it'll probably be twice that for us then.
So you mentioned Mark a minute ago. So I just wanted to just come back to some band history stuff here. So a lot of people have been in and out of Chicks Dig It, particularly in your rhythm section over the past 25 years. Mm-hmm. A lot of them were in the band, though, for pretty long stints. And I know a few of them, you shared some pictures of them at the actual anniversary show that you guys did.
Right.
So do you keep touch with, say, like Mike and Dave and Jason at this point? Do you know where they are?
Yeah, of course. Like we all are busy, but, you know, and we don't hang out nearly as much as we used to, but yeah, we definitely I talk to all those guys, you know.
So Mike is a software guy at this point. This is Mike Eggermint, bass player.
That's right, yeah, and he's doing really well, despite our current economy. He's done really well for himself.
I saw he has a LinkedIn profile and a beard, so that looks very respectable. So
there you go. There's proof he's doing well. He's got a LinkedIn profile and a beard.
So Dave Alcock, is Sunday Sound still around?
No, it's not anymore. And he's working, here. He, works in television.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. So, and he's doing great as well. And Jason, he's an engineer. So
there are so many punk rock guys that I've learned over the years are engineers. A handful of the Teenage Bottle Rocket people, I'm pretty sure are engineers. And
well, I'm sure they are. Yeah.
So on the record, you spent a good deal of time, talking about Germany, before hopping back to Western Canada and then into California. And what immediately sort of leaped out to me listening to this, and this has sort of always been the case, with your band and with a lot of, bands of similar backgrounds, is these Canadian references that pop up, and they just jump out and stick in my head. And the Canadian thing has always been a huge part of like Chicks Dig It's artwork and look and everything like that. It's something you've absolutely like worn on your sleeve as you've gone out into the world. Was that a conscious, like, artistic decision that you guys sat down and made at some point, like to tie the brand of Chicks Dig It so closely with Canada? Like how did that come about? Because not all bands do that. It's not a given that that's going to happen.
Well, I think when we first started touring, we were doing a lot. When we first started really touring, we were doing a lot of time in the States, and we would do, you know, 8 months a year, and six and a half of that would be in the U.S. And so we were always like, hey, we're from Canada, and it kind of got to be a bit of a joke to our friends that would come to see us in these different places that we're from Canada. So we started to kind of play it up a little bit. And I think it definitely came from that. And yeah, so that's kind of where it came from. And then, I remember Tom Bagley, you know, touched on that on our first album cover. You know, there's little Canadian flags here and there. And second album is Born on the 1st of July. And then From Scene to Shining Scene, that's a Canadian reference too, or an American one, I'm not sure. And anyway, but yeah, like we love Canada, you know, it's a great place to live and be from, you know, and you know, it's not a perfect country for sure, but you know, it's yeah, I mean, it's given us a lot of things, you know.
See, I feel that those kinds of references play so differently here in Canada than they would in, at least in the US or another country. I mean, we're so dominated by, you know, US cultural exports that a lot of the times when you're a kid and you find out that there's art being made and it's being made by, you know, your people, your peers, all, it really resonates. It really matters. And I've never really seen it as a nationalism thing as much as it is like a representation thing. Like when I was a young kid learning that, you know, punk rock was out there, it was from New York or it was from California or some London or anything like that. The fact that I could, and again, this was the 90s. So who knows what was going on in Toronto at the time. Right. So this was when we learned that, oh, hey, you know, you could listen to the Planet Smashers out of Montreal, or you could listen to Chicks Dig It out of Calgary, like the Smugglers out of Vancouver. Like, it was like, holy shit, there's Canadians that are doing this. And that really mattered, at least to me.
Well, that's cool. Yeah. I mean, and it mattered to us. I mean, the Smugglers, you know, they were, Bryce from the Smugglers was in a band in town called the Vindicators. And that was one of the first bands I saw. They played my high school and I saw them play with a band called the LI-150s, which is kind of a legendary Calgary band, and another legendary Calgary band called the High Rollers, which is kind of like a they're kind of like a funk band, but really funny guys, and like they put on a really good show. And they played my school, and that was the first time I thought, wow, I can do this. It was like people in my town that are doing this, and I didn't really know that much about Canadian music. I just saw guys from my neighborhood doing it, and so it's, I guess it's kind of the same kind of thing. It's like, you know, those guys, you know, showed me that we could do it, and you know, at least that it was possible, you know.
So one of the things, speaking of the Smugglers, I guess, that was pretty neat for me about 2012 is that you name check a whole ton of bands in there. You mentioned the Smugglers, you mentioned the Riff Randalls, and these are always bands that I've associated you with. You also mentioned Masked Intruder on here, which I think, you know, like of any young band, I guess, you could argue has a pretty strong branch in the musical family tree back to what you guys were doing. So, sure. In a wider sense, that kind of pop punk that they play, I mean, them and we mentioned Teenage Bottle Rocket, it seems like in the past 10 years or so, a lot of that's come into fashion, at least within the punk scene. What's your read on that? Do you see that? Do you see all these young bands doing the kind of stuff that you were doing? Like, did you miss the money train? What?
Yeah, I don't know. I think there is no money train, but yeah, no, I think... In terms of fashion, I have no idea, but I would say that there's a lot more bands that I'm hearing that I like. So I don't know if that means anything, but I don't know about popular opinion or anything.
Well, we're talking about popular opinion within the punk scene, which isn't really for popular sure. opinion anywhere, I guess. But it feels like there's a lot more bands that are doing something that I think is stylistically similar to what Chicks Dig It was doing, and I feel like underappreciated for doing back in the 90s. So I mean, is that do you encounter these bands on the road? Do you hear? Are they telling you things like, oh, hey, you influenced us, or?
Yeah, I mean, we've heard things like that, you know, and from different bands, and but I mean, you know, I definitely don't feel like we're underappreciated or anything. I don't feel like we're missing out or anybody's taking anything. Like, I think people are realizing that, you know, people in some of the bands that you're talking about, that is fun music to play, and it's great music to, like, you know, make for, to have other people have fun too while they're watching you. So, you know, that's about it for me. You know what I mean? I don't know.
So what bands are you seeing out there that you're either playing with or seeing live or hearing that you're impressed with these days?
Well, I mean, and they're not young bands. I don't think Masked Intruder is a young band, but I think they're a newer band. I like them a lot, and the Copyrights I like a lot. Sort of in our style, and a band called the Mangies from Italy, I love that band. You know, I think they are underappreciated over here because maybe, you know, they're from Europe and don't get over here much. But trying to think of who else. I mean, it's not very often. New stuff makes it into my collection as well. That's important to know. Who else? Mean Jeans. I love Mean Jeans. I don't know. I like Andrew Jackson Jihad or AJJ. Yeah, I mean, yeah.
So the you mentioned
that's a
you
tough question to answer.
It is, I know, and it's hard sometimes to recall it when actually someone puts you on the spot for it too. You mentioned Europe, specifically the band out of Italy, and when we mentioned Germany earlier here. I've always felt that you guys have a particular Europe thing. I don't know if it's just because I've been listening to 2012 and you talk so much about it, but you guys always seem to have like big German tours that seem to go places that other bands that I see that go over there to do, you know, a couple festival dates don't seem to go. Is there a particular European thing that works for you? Does Chicks Dig It play better over in Europe than they do here? What?
It's a very simple answer. The number one reason why we never play the United States is these like cost prohibitive work permits. And we would have to join the musicians union, which doesn't do anything other than get you work permits to play in the United States. And it's, you know, for me, we can go to Europe without any work permits and play and you know what? And so that's basically the biggest thing. I mean, Europe's easy to go to because you don't have to go through all these months of bullshit to you know, go lose money there in the first place. You know what I mean? So, you know, you're not paying thousands of dollars to go to Europe just to get the work permits like you are in the United States, you know? So that's a huge reason why we go to Europe a lot. And we've kept going there because, and it's also fun to play. They treat bands very well there. And there's a lot of things to do during the day. We're kind of tourists. So, I mean, it's a lot of non-rock and roll reasons why we go to Europe a lot.
Yeah, no, that makes sense. I mean, that issue, I feel like, has been talked about and repeated from, I think, every Canadian band that I've talked to over over like 15 years at this point. And that's one that just says, you know, it doesn't matter how many free trade agreements we have, that never seems to get better.
Well, and American musicians don't have to pay anything to come into Canada. Yet we have to pay to go there, you know, and look, I would love to play the States more, but I just, you know, as a band, I mean, you know, we almost can't afford to.
Yeah.
You know, it's cheaper to pay for 5 plane tickets than it is for one person's work permit. 5 plane tickets to Europe than it is for one person's work permit to play in the States, you know?
And I assume you don't have to pull any of the weird bullshit that bands play to get things like merch over the border or anything like that?
Well, no, I mean, we just, you know, have it made there. I mean, it's just, you know, so we're actually making money for people there and, you know, they see that, you know? We're not pulling a lot of money out of any of these places, right? So, I don't know.
So, I guess we can't wrap this up here without mentioning the beer, because I feel that Melanie would be really disappointed if I didn't. So Ottawa's Big Rig Brewery, they put together a Chicks Dig It beer. It's going to be on sale at a bunch of the upcoming shows in Ontario, at least. And we've seen a bunch of bands do stuff like this lately where they're doing some work with craft brewers, given how, I guess, hot the craft brewery scene is right now. But how much input does one have into having a beer made in your name? Like, how did this come about?
Well, I think, you know, for us, I don't know about how the other bands did it, but, well, Melanie was talking with Big Rig about doing, like, working with them, and she mentioned that she was working with me, and, you know, it kind of came out of that. So she really, you know, set the whole thing up, and it's great. And I spent a day in Toronto. This is the research and the and all the development aspect of it. I went to Toronto and tried all this different beer for a day. And then...
That sounds horrible.
Yeah, I know. It was terrible. And then, they said, what do you like? What do you want it to taste like? And then this and this. And then it's sort of... That's just pretty much it, you know? And whereas I know, like, you know, Johnny Hansen from the Hansen Brothers, I mean, he spent years honing his craft in Germany, learning how to make smoked beer, well, I spent an afternoon getting drunk with these guys from Big Rig, you know, so there's, I think, different, you know, levels of what went into making the beer. So that was my commitment. It's like, yeah, I like to drink this. It tastes good.
You both ended up with beer in the end. So I guess you really have to argue, you know, who's made a better use of their time.
Well, I mean, but he got to spend all his time in Germany learning this ancient craft. And, but you know, it, you're right. Either way you win.
So, one last thing here is that there's been some mention, and I'm not quite sure how much of this stuff is out there in the world right now of you doing some solo stuff. What's the status on this?
Yeah, I did some touring in Europe with Kepi, and I did some touring out west here with Joey Cape and the One Week Records guys. And yeah, it's just something I'm kind of doing for fun right now. I mean, I haven't worked on any songs specifically for that or anything, but yeah, it's just something that I've kind of been dipping my toe into for the last 2 years. So, but well, I think eventually I'll do something.
If you're going to be like any other punk frontman that's done this, you're going to have to get yourself a banjo and a flannel shirt and a beard.
Well, I have all those things. I just haven't left the house yet. Except the beard. I have grown a beard, a 3 or 4 day beard in the past, which I think is enough to get you by at an acoustic show. Yeah, the other stuff I already got. I got a banjo and lots of flannel shirts.
Looks like you're there. You got screwed around, and it made you really sad to get over.